This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. How's your Friday? Good to be catching up with you before the weekend. And wanted to talk about, well, a few things to get through, but a Western Australian winery has taken out the award for Best Shiraz at the Royal Melbourne Wine Awards. So I wonder if you can guess which wine-growing region in Western Australia that particular Shiraz comes from. Might not be really obvious at first, but if you've got a guess, you can text 0448 922 604. The results of this week's wool market. Danny Burkett going through the details before the news at 1 o'clock. The market down again this week. And also taking you to the Esperance show after 12:30 today. It's been quite a challenging time for the farmers in that region, as it has pretty much everywhere around the state. But having a frost this time in that Esperance zone. And also, of course, the lack of rain, the ongoing dry. So we'll catch up with a few farmers wandering around the Esperance show, just see how things are faring in the lead up to harvest this season. That's after 12:30 today. But speaking of the grain industry, Australia's wheat crop is forecast to drop to levels not seen since the millennium drought. This time, this year. The agribusiness team at NAB estimates the national wheat crop will be about 15.5 million tonnes this year. And only last month it was forecasting a wheat crop of 20 million tonnes. So that's a 22% drop in the crop estimate in just a month. NAB's agribusiness economist Finn Zabel says even with the lower production, prices are unlikely to rise to the dizzying heights of last year. He says heat waves, frost and drought have really knocked the wheat crop around this season.
Look, what we've done this month is given a pretty big reduction to our assessment of where we think wheat will be this season. Now, I should preface it by saying this really is a best guess. We are getting late in the season, but there have been quite a wide range of forecasts from some of the forecasters, just, you know, surrounding a lot of the uncertainty in the season. Our headline number is about 15.5 million tonnes. You know, for reference, you'd probably expect Australia to do 24 million tonne of wheat in an average season. So it is well below average. When I look around the country at where we're seeing, you know, good and bad performance, we'll start in the west. Western Australia, we see 6.5 million tonnes of wheat. Now, that is well below average, but they will still get a crop. You have to remember WA had an absolute cracker of a season last season, second biggest crop on record, so it is coming off that, but it is a bit below average. So the real challenge for the west has really been around frost and heat events recently. SA, 3.5 million tonnes, bit below average. A lot will be cut for hay. Vic, 3.5 million tonnes, which is actually not bad. And then New South Wales, very, very poor performance.
Is this kind of a very like bottom end, very conservative sort of estimate then? Are you sort of like forecasting for like the almost the worst possible scenario?
It is a low end estimate and we are forecasting for one of the worst scenarios. And the challenge is now, you know, we're in the middle of October. The finish will be important, but, you know, you start getting into a period sooner rather than later where rainfall becomes a risk rather than a benefit. And I think that's a challenge. And these frost and heat events, I think, are the real wild card in terms of production. You know, we know that rainfall has been below average in a lot of areas, but being hit by frost and then hit by heat, you know, in very short periods of time can wreak havoc on crops. And we sort of won't really know until harvest where it lands. Having said that, CSIRO's GrainCast model early October was based on area planted with ABARES data, was talking about a crop around this amount. So it's not wildly different from some of the estimates you're seeing put out there as well.
So you said that New South Wales was going to be way down, for example. Could you just give me an idea, how much is New South Wales going to be down by?
Well, we reckon it's going to be in the sort of 1.75 million ton range for wheat. Now, it might do a bit better than that, but we don't think it'll do a lot better than that. And you have to put it in context. New South Wales in a reasonable season will do 5-6 plus million tonnes of wheat. So outside the Southern Riverina in New South Wales, it's very, very tough conditions. And even, you know, a lot of the crop which had been looking okay in New South is now likely to be cut for hay. So, you know, really the weak link in the national production figure is New South Wales.
So say that this forecast is accurate, where would that put this harvest in Australia's history? Would this be a particularly bad reduction?
The bottom line is that it would be a very low number, the lowest since, I think, 07, 08, off the top of my head. That's millennium drought level bad, and I think that's a challenge because post-millennium drought, we did have some pretty good seasons, and we've had some really good seasons, but now we're looking at sort of very tough conditions in a lot of areas, and they, you know, manifest themselves as millennium drought level bad wheat harvests.
NAB agribusiness economist Finn Zabel with Lucas Forbes. 10 past 12. The state's main grain handler, the CBH Group, is just putting the finishing touches on the last of the permanent storage projects for this harvest, investing a record $240 million in network capital and maintenance. The largest upgrade took place at McLevy receival site, which has tripled in size with 236,000 tonnes of new storage space added, with a total capacity of 330,000 tonnes. Other storage upgrades took place at Cranbrook, Wickapen and Broom Hill, and various other sites had upgrades to inload facilities and new weighbridges. CBH's General Manager Operations Ben McNamara says the investment is all about making it easier for growers to deliver their crops and easier for customers to buy it.
Critically, throughout the year, we're also outturning the grain to key customers, and that means we've got to take that grain from each of our upcountry sites and drop it down to each of our ports. So for this, if I'm thinking about the Albany supply chain, where we're talking about Broom Hill, the critical thing there is obviously loading trains effectively and getting them down to the port nice and quickly. And there's a bit of work to be done in this space.
Do you know how often bottlenecks were happening at Broom Hill before this?
I don't have that data in front of me, but really it'll come down to the turnaround time of the site, which is where that would highlight this for us. I mean, across the board, our turnaround time, when you include queue time, is around about the 44-minute mark. Some sites are better, some are worse. And that's an average, and we're looking at that throughout the day. Obviously, there's times in the day where turnaround times are longer, and that can typically occur in the morning rush and sometimes towards the end of the day as well. We want to make sure that growers can understand what that turnaround time is from their paddock to the site and back to the paddock so they can plan their on-farm logistics as well.
It sounds like that average turnaround time is a key metric for you guys. It's 45 minutes at the moment. Do you have any specific target in mind when you think about reducing it?
This year we want to pull some more time off that, so we're aiming for 43 minutes. What that means is obviously we've got to look at each of our sites and identify where those bottlenecks are. So, for example, this year we've addressed some of the weighbridge issues. We've also looked and upgraded some of our grids, which are performing below our expectations. These are the sensible things that we're trying to approach on each of the sites. We've done some of that work, but we're realistic and we understand there's lots more to go.
The overall investment by CBH in these network upgrades, though, that has been made public. It's $240 million. It seems like a lot of money, but CBH is a $3 billion company with a huge footprint and a lot of legacy assets. So is that investment enough?
I think that remains to be seen as I continue to get myself into the seat. I've been sitting here for 6 months. We're continuing to assess that. $240 million this year is the largest amount we've ever spent on the network. Is it enough? Listen, I think the critical thing is ensuring that we're making the network sustainable for future generations of farmers. So that's very much a focus of both the board and the management team here at CBH.
CBH's General Manager Operations, Ben McNamara with Daniel Mercer. 14 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
The Australian Livestock Export Council says the resumption of the trade to the Middle East has been a success because the first shipment has recorded a low mortality rate. In fact, well under the 1% threshold that triggers an investigation. The sheep were on board the El Masila, loaded in Fremantle late last month and bound for the Persian Gulf with the final drop-off at Qatar. This was the first ship to leave Western Australia following the moratorium on live exports to the Northern Hemisphere, which lasted almost 4 months. Australian Livestock Export Council CEO Mark Harvey-Sutton says it's all good news so far.
The shipment went very well by all accounts. There was a mortality rate of 0.24%, and that's out of a total number of sheep around 54,000. So that's an excellent result. It's certainly a much better result than we have seen in the past. So we're seeing an improvement, which is excellent. And by all accounts too, you know, there were a couple of hot periods, but they were managed very well. By all accounts, there was no adverse animal welfare outcomes as a result of those hot times. So I think the export has done an outstanding job in this instance.
And 0.24%, that's well below the 1% that's reportable. But those mortalities, did they occur because of the heat, or why did they happen?
Look, I don't have the exact details. That's still coming out, and we will see that when the Independent Observer and the other reporting mechanisms that come out of the vessel come forward. Although it's not the best measure, there will always be a level of mortality on shipments. And I think what we've seen here is not unusual, and in fact, it's better than what we normally see. So I think that's what we have to take into account. The improvements are excellent, and we will be continuing to apply the right methods. But there is a lot of reporting that occurs on the vessel, so no doubt they will detail where the mortalities came from.
And the exporter was Retwa. The sheep were shipped during that October period, which people are still pretty nervous about. Now, the RSPCA wants to see that trading ban expanded to cover October. Do you think it could be done safely during the month?
I do. And there's a few reasons for that. One of the real positives out of the reforms of last year was the application of reduced stocking densities during the shoulder periods around that three-month moratorium. And what we're seeing as a result of that is the animals have more space. That does have an impact on the level of heat that's experienced by the animals, because more animals creates more heat. So yes, it is. It is on the shoulder period of those hot months, but we've put forward a very robust and strong evidence-based submission into the regulatory consideration of what happens post-moratorium that recently occurred. And, you know, we're very confident that with the right management practices in place, we'll continue to see very successful shipments.
And we know that sheep are allowed to be shipped during this period, but were any others actually, did they actually leave ports?
There's been a shipment subsequent to this one that's landed. I'll have to get the details of that one. I don't think that one has landed yet. We're starting to hit the period where shipments will continue to move pretty regularly. So we'll be continuing to monitor those results, and I'm very confident that we'll see some very drastic improvement and also some excellent outcomes from the voyages.
Overall, though, is it a decrease in the amount of animals, especially sheep, that are actually leaving Australia?
We have seen a decrease in the total volumes, and that's to be expected when you don't export for 3 months of the year. You can't make up that number in the other months. So, yes, there has been a decrease, but it's always worth remembering that moratorium of 3 months was actually put forward by the exporters to manage what exporters themselves believe to be the high-risk period for animal welfare. So even though there has been a reduction in numbers, the trade remains very sustainable and demand from our trading partners continues to be strong.
There has been a decrease in sheep shipped, and there's been a lot of uncertainty hanging over the industry. Do you think that exporters will continue to go to other countries instead of places like WA because they sort of see it as too difficult?
No, I don't. I mean, it'll happen to some extent. And we did see that during the moratorium period. Some of our importing partners sourced consignments of sheep from countries like Romania and South Africa. And that's a supply issue. You know, we will see a little bit of increased competition. But the reason that I have extreme confidence in the industry going forward is because of Australia's reputation as a trusted supplier. And we're starting to see that certainty come back in. And as we see more regular shipments, that confidence will build. But the reason we've had such a long enduring relationship with these countries is because of we stand by the quality of our animals. They're excellent. And it's something Australia should be very proud of and something producers should be very proud of. So I feel very confident. I think you'll start to see that confidence start to come back to the market.
So overall, you think the outlook for live export is good?
I do. And that's being driven by a commitment from exporters themselves to improve, and we are doing that. And I think what you'll continue to see is best practice as we go forward. And that's something that must be maintained. It's what we expect, what the community expects, and we will deliver.
Alec, CEO Mark Harvey Sutton, catching up with Kit Mockin, 20 past 12. A Western Australian winery has taken out a trifecta of awards, including Best Shiraz at the prestigious Royal Melbourne Wine Awards. I wonder if you can guess which wine-growing region it's in. It's not Margaret River. It's not Denmark or Mount Barker either. It's in the Franklin River region, about 360 kilometres south of Perth. Franklin Estate Winery won Best Shiraz in Australia, Best Shiraz in Western Australia, and also Best Organic Biodynamic Wine in Show. Hunter Smith owns the winery and he says this is a great recognition for the whole Franklin River region.
You know, obviously really humbled. I mean, there's over 4,000 wines from around Australia that go into the mix for these awards. And so to be at the pointy end of that is fantastic and a great recognition to obviously a lot of hard work that all the team at Franklin Estate put in. You know, these things just don't happen overnight. They're quite often a long grind of a philosophy and an approach to winemaking that you hope one day gets the recognition that you hope for, and look, this is a good step to that. So we're really, really pumped. Yep.
And was it the same wine that won all three awards?
Yeah, it was. So it's our 2017 Isolation Ridge Vineyard Shiraz. So that's the vineyard site that my parents planted back in 1988. So we celebrated 30 years last year. And once vines start getting to that age and, you know, the organic production philosophy that we have, we just, the vineyards really come to life, literally, and you know, the wines are absolutely speaking for themselves and sit really quite nicely. You know, this wine, the Shiraz, we've been toiling away with for, you know, a long time, of course, and, you know, sits so well alongside the Isolation Ridge Riesling that we're probably most famous for, but it's great to get this recognition for the Shiraz.
And can you remember that vintage? Did you know at the time that it was going to make a really good red?
Yeah, we did. I mean, 2017 was a fantastic year and we just got a really lovely slow ripening period. So we got great hang time and then we just got these very cold nights. And when you get those cold nights leading into the harvest, you know that you're going to capture a lot of, you know, fruit flavours in the wine. So we knew we were up to something special and we just had to, you know, look after it. We have a very sort of hands-off approach to our winemaking and really try to reflect that single vineyard style or single vineyard characteristics of those ironstone soil types that the Isolation Ridge vineyards planted in. We really like to get those ironstone flinty characters coming through in the wine, and we certainly, you know, the hands-off approach certainly helps us do all that. So look, it was just a matter of looking after it and doing the right things. And, yeah, really, really pleased that the family, after all this time of toiling away in both vineyard and winery, have picked up this sort of recognition.
In the scheme of things, how big a deal is this award?
Well, it is huge. I mean, it's the best wine, best Shiraz in Australia, which is no mean feat. And Western Australia traditionally, you know, has, I believe, always been sort of overlooked when it comes to producing top-quality Shiraz. But I think the Franklin River region is really starting to hit its stride with Shiraz, and, you know, it's got all the makings to be a benchmark region of Australia, and if not globally, the Shiraz varietal. So we're really pumped. I mean, from the best Shiraz, we were nominated for the Jimmy Watson, which in winemaking circles, Jimmy Watson Trophy is the absolute pinnacle. So we were unfortunately just pipped at the post by another one. But look, this is absolutely unbelievable to take away, really. I mean, and huge recognition for the brand internationally as well.
And you're the president of the Franklin River Wine Growers Association still?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Yeah, because if you go over east, Margaret River is a well-known, I guess, household name when it comes to a region known for its wine. Great Southern yep. less so, and, you know, like you mentioned, Franklin River probably doesn't get the recognition it deserves. What do you think this will do for the broader Franklin River region's reputation?
Well, Franklin River and the Great Southern, I mean, but technically Franklin River is a sub-region of the Great Southern, and certainly the Great Southern, you know, name and reputation is growing very, very quickly in more recent times, just as people look for more sort of table-friendly wines or food-friendly wines. And so they possess, you know, Franklin River, Great Southern, they possess this style of wine that's absolutely food-friendly and absolutely, you know, it has this lovely weight and power that comes with elegance. And that style around the world is starting to really be championed. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of really good uptake and awareness of the region. And look, I mean, we're only in the very early days. We've only been growing grapes in the Great Southern for sort of 52 years, I believe. So compared to some of the great wine regions of the world that have been doing it for, you know, hundreds of years, you know, we've got a bit of a way to go, but all this certainly helps.
Well, congratulations again. I'll let you get back into the lunch so you can say your thank yous.
Thank you very much.
Hunter Smith, he's the owner of Franklin River Winery, talking to Tyne Logan, and pretty happy with that award, being awarded the best Shiraz in Australia, the best in Western Australia, and what was the other one? Also the best organic biodynamic wine in show. Not a bad haul. 27 past 12 here on the Country Hour. You know how, well, for the past sort of week or so, I've been talking about the dry conditions around parts of Western Australia. And we were talking about the Gascoyne and Nullarbor pastoralists saying they can't remember too many drier times than right now. Well, this week, WA Farmers Chief Executive Trevor Whittington has been in Canberra, and he says he's been trying to make sure that the National Farmers Federation and those in the east realise the seriousness of WA's drought. But he says a lot of the talks have been about preparing a national policy for future droughts.
There is a national strategy from the Commonwealth, but the states all have slightly different approaches. And what the NFF has been calling for is some coordination and standardisation of drought policies. And this is probably more for the next drought rather than this one, so that everyone's very clear what is going to be available and what's not. And that's a very difficult thing to achieve because all the states have slightly different approaches.
What is your organisation's policy on how the government and farmers should manage drought and severe water deficient seasons?
We've got a lot less farmers and they're probably a lot bigger, and we don't have the sort of much longer extended droughts that the eastern states seems to suffer through. Now, WA Farmers is very clear that farmers have to be self-reliant, and the days of having state or Commonwealth governments be the lender of last resort, you know, to bail out farmers who don't have the equity available to carry them through a drought has gone. But we do expect the state government and the federal government to provide that sort of community level, immediate individual family food on table support, which they do. The last thing is to ensure that the country towns have access to town water supply when areas are, you know, are very dry for stock and households, and that's a bit of an issue at the moment in some parts of WA.
But how can farmers prepare for drought when they are in drought?
Well, the reality is every single one of those farmers would have gone through a drought before, and they've also would have had good years, and it's up to them to ensure that they access the farm management deposits and structure their businesses appropriately so that they can carry themselves through these years. You know, drought is nothing new, and it should be very much a part of everyone's farm business planning program. And look, and the reality is they do. They're very good at it, managing it. And, you know, we're lucky at the moment with a low interest rate environment that capital is relatively cheap. And then there's a question of asset values, and luckily they've been going up too. So for time to suffer through a drought with low interest rates, it does take a bit of the pressure off.
WA Farmers Chief Executive Trevor Whittington with Emma Field. It's 12:30. Let's check news headlines now with Vicky Saleur.
Thanks, Belle. Well, in the news, the Premier Mark McGowan has called for an inquiry into the state's racing industry after the mistreatment of racehorses in eastern state abattoirs was revealed by the ABC 7:30 program. Mr McGowan says he's appalled by the practices revealed in the story and says the interim advice he's received is there's no evidence that what happened in New South Wales and Queensland is happening in Western Australia. Media organisations condemn suggestions they haven't done enough to publicise changes to national security laws. Two parliamentary investigations are currently underway into whether the tougher laws have come at the expense of protections for journalists and whistleblowers. ABC News Director Gavin Morris says media organisations make lengthy submissions to Parliament when such proposals are put forward. And US President Donald Trump has praised his Turkish counterpart over a deal that's brought about a temporary cessation of hostilities in northern Syria. The deal was reached after talks between Turkey's president and the US Vice President Mike Pence. And I'll have more news at 1:00.
Vicky, thank you so much for the update. 29:1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Barischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Still to come between now and the news at 1:00, a wrap of this week's wool market. Taking you to the Esperance show, we'll catch up with a few farmers, just sort of check the pulse on the season so far and in the lead up to harvest and how dung beetles are tackling climate change. First, off to the Bureau and Austin Watkins. How's it looking in eastern and northern parts?
No real change to the story from yesterday. We're still expecting the shower and thunderstorm activity to increase over the next few days as we see a number of troughs forming. Today, there's fairly patchy activity through the interior, and we expect it to develop through the southeast Pilbara this afternoon. And sort of by tomorrow, we expect that activity to continue through the interior district and then extend during the afternoon into the coastal Kimberley and the southeast of the Kimberley as well. And also into the west of the Gascoyne, the adjoining Pilbara and the northern goldfields. Very little rainfall expected from any of that activity, but on Sunday it's probably a bit of a chance of any rainfall from those showers and thunderstorms, and we expect them to form in those similar areas again. However, a trough moving through the central parts of the state, we'll see that activity extend through the goldfields as well and into the western Eucla. And that trough will move eastwards on Monday. So the activity continuing once more through the northern and central parts of the state and reaching the, sort of the South Australian border during the afternoon. And then when that trough moves a bit further eastwards, we'll see that southern extent of those storms just contract back into the Eucla as well. So, plenty of activity for the next 4 days, but, not a great deal of rainfall expected and generally pretty patchy activity on those troughs.
And what's the story for the Southwest Land Division, Austin?
Well, a little bit of change from the forecast from yesterday. We are anticipating a little bit more activity developing down the trough, which is forming near the west coast tomorrow. So that's going to bring a little bit of heat to those western districts. And we may see the chance of a shower or thunderstorm developing through the inland central west and the adjacent central wheat belt, mainly the late afternoon and evening. And that activity may just creep over over midnight into Sunday and develop a little bit further through the sort of the central and the eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. Not counting on a great deal of rain coming out of those, and it'll be fairly patchy if they do develop. But with that trough moving through on Sunday, we'll see it east of the Southwest Land Division by Monday. So pretty much clearing up during Monday. However, a new ridge of high pressure will just be developing over the southwest, and a bit of onshore flow may produce the odd light shower about the southwest district there. And then on Tuesday, it looks like we'll see a weak cold front just brush the western south coast, and that'll produce some showers mainly in areas southwest of a line from Bunbury to Bremer Bay. Once again, it's not looking too promising in terms of rainfall from that feature on Tuesday. So all in all, a little bit more activity, but we're not expecting a great deal of rainfall, and if there was a little bit, it'd be fairly patchy over the next 4 days.
And warnings this afternoon?
So warnings-wise, we've got a strong wind warning for the Geraldton and the Lancelin coast this afternoon, and tomorrow the winds will increase along the Esperance coast in those easterlies. And we've also got a fire weather warning current for the interior, the Ashburton inland and the Gascoyne inland fire weather districts.
Austin, thank you for going through those details. 25 to 1, no rainfall over 5 millimetres anywhere across Western Australia in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. Earlier, we were hearing from Trevor Whittington from WA Farmers, the lobby group here, one of the lobby groups here, and talking about how he's been over the east and talking about the dry conditions here and just trying to raise awareness of that. This through on the text. For the people over east to know the seriousness of our drought, they first need to know that we exist. 0448 922 604 if you've got a comment to throw in the mix this afternoon. Now, a farmer in Western Australia's southwest is using charcoal and dung beetles to improve his soils and tackle climate change. Might sound a little bit out there, a little bit wacky, but this innovative approach has attracted interest from researchers in Europe, China, and the United States. Basically, Doug Powell feeds biochar or charcoal to his cattle, and he uses Mediterranean beetles to bury their nutrient-rich manure into the soil on his property near Manjimup, about 300 kilometres south of Perth.
When we first bought this farm, I noticed there were active dung beetles in the winter. These beetles were burying virtually every dung pat on this farm down as deep as 600 millimetres in the ground. The connection with biochar came after a very interesting talk here in Manjimup and explained the effectiveness of using GPS-controlled grain farming seeding equipment to put charcoal in the ground, which was made from grain straw on the same farm that it was being buried on, and then using the same GPS-controlled seeding equipment to plant the seed of the next grain crop over the top of the char in the ground. And they were getting an increase in productivity. And I thought, well, that's pretty fantastic. How could I put that information into effect in a place like Manjimup, where we grow horticultural crops, we grow tree crops, and we grow livestock, and we have little narrow gates and big high hills, and we have very small tractors, and we can't...
Not the big seeding rigs.
No, we can't pull 100-metre-wide equipment up mountainsides with 1,000-horsepower tractors, and we're not likely to buy them. Anyway, the result of that thought was I would attempt to feed some charcoal to my cattle, let it go through the cattle, fall out the other end, and hopefully the beetles would bury the dung of the beetle of the cow that they were already burying together with the charcoal and put it deep in the ground permanently.
You said you wanted to make this profitable. One thing to do this at a loss and have it subsidised, but for it to be widely adopted, you need it to make money. How has it proven its value on your farm?
We've had two increases in productivity. One is the soil has become more fertile. It's actually releasing the phosphorus that has been locked up in the soil, and this part of the world's had a lot of added phosphorus. If we can use the charcoal to actually unlock that phosphorus and the beetles to bring that phosphorus from deep in the ground locked in that subsoil back up to the surface, that is a big advantage.
And I mean, you saw benefits to your pasture growth and your fertility overall in your soil, but you also saw some interesting improvements to the health and production of the beef cattle that are feeding off those pastures.
Yeah, certainly did, actually. The main bacteria in a cow's rumen that actually does the digestion for the cow, that's a methanogenic bacteria.
And what does methanogenic mean?
It gives off methane. It's a byproduct. The biochar particles, they're just carbon, but they're full of all the little spaces that used to be the vascular system of the plant. When the cow eats that material, those little spaces are still there, and they're a free-living bacteria in the soil that actually live on methane. These are methanotrophic bacteria. When the cow's got these little particles of biochar in its gut, they can proliferate and live in a very protected way within that biochar in the pore spaces. And what they live on is the methane that are being produced by the methanogenic bacteria, the normal fermentation bacteria in the cow's gut. The combination to the cow is just more bacteria. And
more nutrients, essentially.
Yeah, more food for the cow. The cow actually doesn't consume, it eats the grass, but it doesn't actually live on the grass. It lives on the bacteria that actually live on the grass, a two-stage system.
Explain to me the role of these European dung beetles or African dung beetles that have been brought to Australia to help feed and cycle through cattle droppings, essentially.
Yeah. Initially, cows and sheep, or ruminants, were brought to Australia without the population of beetles, which live right across a year in all the different soil types and all the different climates that all fill little niches and compartments within the dung and the day and the night and fit together to actually bury the maximum amount of that animal manure in the ground. We missed a big component of that animal process that was brought to
Australia. Ecosystem, I suppose.
We only brought part of the ecosystem.
And I guess without those beetles being around to cycle the dung through the soil, what happens to that nutrients?
Well, the nitrogen component pretty quickly becomes nitrous oxide and goes straight up into the atmosphere. That's a greenhouse gas. If a beetle can bury that dung very quickly, that doesn't become a greenhouse gas. It becomes the soil fertility adjunct in the ground, extra nitrogen, always good for plants.
What kind of potential do you see in more people, more farms in Australia kind of embracing what sounds to be quite a natural but effective approach?
What sort of effect? I think we could end up with a very huge industry making biochar out of waste product from agriculture and waste products from forestry at a profit put into the ground by animals and insects.
Doug Powell explaining to John Daly and you why he uses dung beetles and charcoal or biochar on his Manjimup beef farm, which is in WA's southwest region. And Doug recently received the Australian Government Innovation in Agriculture Land Management Award at the 2019 WA Landcare Awards. And that means he's in the mix for the National Award in 2020. So good luck. There is an online article if you want to read all the details about Doug's innovative use of beetles and biochar. So, as always, there is a link for you on the ABC Rural Facebook page if you want to get to that article quickly. And a few comments underneath too. Bobby says, dung beetles are amazing and have many beneficial ecological consequences, such as soil fertilisation and aeration, improved nutrient cycling and uptake by plants, increase in pasture quality, biological control of pest flies and intestinal parasites, and secondary seed dispersal. Some of these ecological functions can be considered to be ecosystem services because of their potentially large economic importance and positive impacts on human well-being. Thank you, Bobby. And Courtney's tagged a friend just asking, reckon the sheep will cooperate? Check it out on the ABC Rural Facebook page for those comments and more, and you can just click your way to the link and read through the online article. 16 to 1 here on the Country Hour. We'll get to the wool market just before the news at 1 o'clock. First, though, I want to take you to the south coast of Western Australia just to soak up some of the atmosphere at this year's Esperance Show. It's certainly been a testing time for farmers in the region with frost and, of course, the ongoing dry conditions. Emma Field is at the show. What's the mood like this year, Emma?
Well, Belle, I have spoken to a couple of farmers here at the Esperance Show, and as you can imagine, the mood is a little bit sombre because the season down here has thrown up a lot of challenges, from frost to dry seasons. But look, I think people are just happy to be out and about and off their farm for the day for the Esperance Show. There's certainly a lot of people around town. The shops and the pub last night was packed. But I am joined by a couple of Esperance farmers to talk to us about the season.
Brett South from Beaumont.
Bruce Pengilly from Cascade.
Brett, I'll start with you. You farm east of Esperance at Beaumont. What's the season been like for you?
Yeah, fairly dry season. We had a real dry start. Of course, a wet August, which really came on top of us. If it wasn't for the wet August, we would have been in a fair bit of trouble, but we're pretty grateful for the lot of rain in August, and then we got that awful frost event. Out in Beaumont, it was about it was under 0 degrees for about 6 hours, and then got to minus 2.9. Yeah, a lot of damage, but I don't think it's as bad as we first thought. We went out with the agronomists and, you know, we're thinking maybe 20 to 30% wipeout, but there's a lot of other places around, especially out Salmon Gums Way, they got a lot worse than affected, and a lot more people out Whitnome Hills as well. But I don't think it's as bad as we first thought, but it's the dry condition that's killing us at the moment. It's too late for rain. We had 10 mil last week. That will benefit some of the later crops we got in, but apart from that, yeah, it's definitely the dry that's killing us at the moment.
In terms of yields, I've heard that some farmers are really going to struggle to make a tonne per hectare. Would that be about right?
Yeah, we're probably going to drop at least 30% off our yields this year, I reckon. We've got good patches in there where, you know, some of the wheat, some of the good patches might go 2 tonne, but some of the crappier patches, you know, you'd be lucky to push 1 tonne. But, and we know there's frost in there, but we're not going to know until we put the header in. It's just going to be one of them type of years.
Bruce, you're west of Esperance and you also run a Palmerino stud. What's it been like in terms of pasture and water?
Water's the challenge. We're very light on last year. We've only had 150 mil for the season, the whole year, and a lot of that hasn't run water, so dam levels are very low. But feed-wise, I'm surprised at just what is there. And it's a bit like Brett was saying about the crops. For the amount of water that we've had, for the crops that are there, we're very surprised. The frost has knocked us around. I'm thinking probably half to two-thirds of it have gone. We're thinking probably just across the board we'd insure for half a tonne to the hectare. Some of the wheat will do better than that. But until, like Brett said, until you get the harvester in, you're just not going to know.
And how do you think you're going to get through the summer with the extended dry?
Well, we learned a lot from the last 10 months that we've had. We fed a lot of sheep and put sheep into confinement this year for the first time to any degree. We had weaners in feedlot for nearly 5 months. So basically just keep them alive, and they don't tend to walk, they don't drink as much, so you can survive on very little runoff.
Now, there was some rain last week, and some people said it was good, but for others it was too late. How did it affect your property?
Well, anything that's still green, it'll fill that out. But as far as runoff goes, it was one of those all but nearly, it got to the front of the dams, but just didn't run in. We've cleaned a lot of catchments, but still wasn't quite, because it was such a steady rain and the country's so dry, it's just soaked in and didn't make it into the dam.
So I'll ask a question to both of you. How far do we think we are from you guys starting harvest, Brett?
I'll probably start next Tuesday and Tuesday, Wednesday. We got some field peas that are about ready to go, so desiccated them last week, and some canola not far off that as well. But this will be the last year that we grow canola where we are. We just don't get the early rain, and too low rainfalls, we just can't make canola work where we farm. So this will be our last year with canola, but got to look down the line more of trying to get two break crops in your rotation. So don't have to look towards something. We've grown some veg. We've been growing veg for a couple of years now, and that's been working good for us. So it'll be more field peas and more veg, and have a little play with lentils as well.
So you're going to be on the header soon. How about you, Bruce?
I think we'll be a fortnight to 3 weeks. There's still quite a lot of green in the barley, so we've just got to wait for that. We graze our crops, so that's just put them all back that extra couple of weeks, 3 weeks. So we'll be at least that before we get started.
Now, I have spoken to a lot of farmers and they're all telling me they suspect there's going to be a rain event in November. Bruce, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, you can guarantee it. About 10 days after you pull the harvester out the shed, it'll happen.
Yep, it always happens. By the time you fully get cranked into harvest, it always rains. But we'll see. It's pending to be one of them years where it's going to be a wet harvest, like the rain hasn't come. So hopefully we get a a good clean run at harvest, and the rain can come after that, but that means a lot of summer spraying for weeds.
What are you looking forward to at the show today, Bruce?
Today is just catch up with people. There's a lot of people you only see once a year, and that's at the Esperance Show. We've been coming here for nearly 40 years, displaying our stock for 38 of those, and you see those people you just see once a year.
Same as Bruce has mentioned, get along and see a lot of people that you don't get to see from the other side of town much. You do see them now and again when you go on field walks and stuff like that, but it's always good to come along to the show and have a look at the new machinery and the livestock and catch up with all your mates and people around town.
So there you go, catching up with a few friends and kicking some tyres sounds like that's what's going to go on today. So thanks very much for your time today. And Belle, just one thing, I'm looking forward to the Esperance show. Now, I grew up in Esperance, but I don't think I've been to the show for 25 years. So I've got to go and catch up and have a look at some of the entries. I used to put scone entries in and photos and all that sort of stuff. And I love catching up on the Chook show as well. But I also will just be looking forward to catching up with old friends and new friends.
Well, thank you for that, Emma. Sounds like you're going to be quite busy. And she might just be inspired to put in an entry next year, by the sounds, in the photographic section or the scone section. I think she's just there checking out what the competition's like and then seeing whether she'll put her hand up for next year. Esperance-based rural reporter Emma Field reporting from the Esperance show and catching up with a couple of farmers there, Brett South and Bruce Pingerly, wandering around the show and catching up with some friends I haven't seen for a while. On the Country Hour, 10 minutes to 1 o'clock. Are you a sheep farmer? And if you are, do you sometimes struggle to find shearers when you need them? Well, Australia-wide, there's currently a shortage of shearers and other workers in the wool industry. But a new project in WA's Midwest is trying to address that problem. It's being coordinated by the Aboriginal organisation Mungawala, and the aim is to get more young people into shearing. The organisation is preparing for its first 10-day shearing skills workshop. Bobby Pepper is a shearing and fencing contractor, and he's one of the main organisers.
A lot of the kids who we deal with, they come from a lot of good backgrounds. I knew all their grandparents and all that many years ago. And I got a great rapport with all these kids. We all get along. They all look up to me as Uncle or Pop Bobby. And it's a great thing to give these kids a golden opportunity. We went out this morning to get two or three, but we had to turn a couple away. But very interesting, yes.
And that meeting you had this morning, you had with people in the foundation, some kids who are interested in becoming shearers or involved in the shearing industry, and also the Agriculture Minister, Alana McTiernan. Minister, what role can government play here?
Well, look, we're taking... our government is taking a very proactive role in getting Aboriginal community back into the farming sector. This particular project is part funded by the Department of Primary Industry together with Australian Wool Innovation. We've got an Aboriginal Economic Development Unit that is so focused on creating opportunities for Aboriginal people in agriculture. We've had great programs running on the dog fence where we've had people, including Bobby, come forward and have successfully delivered $5 million worth of renovation on the dog fence. And we have identified shearing as another area, again, that we would love to get the Aboriginal community back in.
Bobby, you were saying earlier about the shortage of shearers that you're really noticing, experiencing at the moment. How many phone calls did it take you to find a few shearers?
I was looking for six shearers 18 months ago to go to a shed. There was a good shed. I had to shear 4,500 sheep there. And I made 100 phone calls and I end up with five shearers. And every phone call these days is a mobile, you know. So there's your day's profit there gone. But when I first heard about the vermin, the state barrier fence, are going to get funded to fix a fence and do all the maintenance on the fence and things like that, and so on, I thought, what a beautiful, great idea. And I thought straight away then that if that fence is fixed, the minister's going to want to get that fence fixed. I said, well, all that's going to mean one thing. And they all said, what's that? I said, spending all that money is going to create... there's going to be 1 million merino sheep back in this area. And they said, oh, gee... That's good. So it's an amazing thing, Minister, that this fence thing's come through, because that's what it's going to mean. And what's the good getting 1 million sheep merino sheep that does need shearing, and there's no shearers. Mm. So what we've done, we've created this thing now, and your support is absolutely amazing. I want to thank you very, very much for...
Bobby, just to wrap up, the 10-day camp that, or the 10-day course that you'll be doing in January, just take me through what that will involve.
We start on the 6th of January at Greg and Jane Teakle's farm there at Ingervale in Northampton. We're going to do a... Through the Mungawala Corporation, we've created a space here to have a two-day workshop. We are going to have a two-day course down here to tell them everything about the of how to welcome yourself into a shearing shed. You can't just walk into a shearing shed and grab a handpiece and shear a sheep. No, you've got to know all the little things before that. But it's going to take 2 days in the classroom, and then the other 8 days are going to be actually in the shearing shed, where we're going to actually watch the kids shear the sheep.
Bobby Pepper, he's one of the organisers of that shearing skills workshop that's going to be held on January the 6th at Greg Teakle's farm at Northampton. Up to 20 kids going to be trained during that course. And Alana McTiernan says she'll see how it goes before considering expanding the training to other parts of the state. 5 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Let's get to the wool market now. And the market was down again this week. The Eastern Market Indicator was down 26 cents to close at 1,517 cents a kilogram clean. And the Western Market Indicator down 32 cents to close at 1,621 cents a kilogram clean. Danny Burkett, how are you reading this market?
Well, if you look at the Fremantle market over the 2 days, the Wednesday and the Thursday, 18 micron fell 50 clean to close at 1770. 19 microns off 40, closing at 1740. 20 micron, 1700 flat for the close, that was off 45. 21s off 40, 1695 for the close. And 22 micron off 35 for the week, 1675. So if you look at that in the decile ranking, in the last 5 years, this is taken from the Melbourne market, very similar to ours. 19 micron today is roughly sitting at the halfway mark, so half the time above today's price, half the time below. 21 micron is at the 66th decile. That is saying that the majority of the time it has spent well below this price. If we look at that in a different light, if we take out the last 2 years, the last year and a half of those magnificent markets we've seen, if we look at the 5 years prior to that, today's 19 micron sits at the 95th decile. So looking without those highs in the market, the 19 micron sat at 95%. So only 5% of the time did it spend above today's price in those previous 5 years. 20, 21 and 22 micron are all sitting at the highest price. So again, just taking out, to be clear, taking out the last year and a half, if we look at the 5 years prior, a 20 micron's price today at 1700 would have been the highest price in that time by 30 cents clean. A 21 micron would set the highest price by a dollar over the market during that period, and roughly the same for 22. So just keeping, as I always like to do, keeping a bigger picture or a larger perspective on the market, today's price is still very healthy. Pieces and bellies across the board, didn't matter what VM, what micron, what length, all off 35 for the week. Lambs up 20, locks up 20, crutchings up 20, stains up 20 to 50 in places, depending if they were combing or whether they were in the short wool market. So all in all, even though the market did fall, we did see some recovery on the second day and that did stabilise. So it was good to walk into the close of the market in Fremantle on a steady note.
And the buyers this week, Danny?
Tech Wool Trading, again, taking the lead, taking 16% of the Merino fleece wool through the three centres. PJ Morris taking 15%. Endeavour Wool and Australian Merino Exports, 11.5% and 9%. So if we look at the skirtings, again, that is still in the combing market. We saw the Australian Merino Exporters, again, they were at 17% of the skirtings across the country and Tech Wool at 15 or 14.5%. So some of those bigger buyers coming in and taking big licks of wool, which is good to see, but also good to see that that spread of buyers continues to flow through the market. So each week we've seen Tech Wool in the last 2 weeks being top place, but the prior weeks to that we've seen Morris, prior to that we've seen TNU, who didn't even mention this week. So they are coming in and getting their fair share of wool.
And what can we expect for next week?
Just shy of 33,000 bars of wool. So We are looking at a very small market next week between Sydney, Melbourne and Fremantle. If you do look, we've offered roughly about 86,000 bales, or we've cleared 86,000 bales less this time of year compared to this time last year. Although looking at last year, you must remember the market was red hot. There was a lot of taxable that came in, was sold on the market. So it's not a true reflection or a true comparison, but noteworthy that 85,000 bales less being sold when you look at this time versus last year. So we are banking up a stock of wool. South African market did continue last week. They have a small bank of wool also waiting to be cleared. But it does bode well given the market finished on the firm note. We walk into next week with some reasonable expectations.
Danny, thank you for that wrap and going through the details for us of this week's wool market, which is down again this week. Good to catch up this Friday afternoon and enjoy your weekend. See you on Monday, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.